I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. If you ask most people to name the great presidents, Washington and Lincoln are likely to come up. But how does Calvin Coolidge rank? This hour, we'll talk with the author of a new book about how presidents were viewed by the people who elected them to office and why some of those perceptions have shifted over time. Also, we'll look at where future generations might rank Barack Obama, George W. Bush, and Bill Clinton among their presidential peers. It's Up to Date, following this hour's news. Here's a parlor game that'll get people yakking in a hurry, the presidential ratings game. Who's the best president of all time? Probably Washington or Lincoln or FDR. But after that, it becomes something of a crapshoot, and this'll get them going. Where does Ronald Reagan rank, or Bill Clinton, or George W. Bush? Longtime Washington correspondent Robert Mary has looked at the ratings game and added a new twist, which is to consider how voters regard these men while they were in office. Robert Mary has put this all together in a new book, Where They Stand, the American Presidents in the Eyes of Voters and Historians. He speaks at the Kansas City Public Library tonight, and he joins me right now. And Bob, so good to have you. Good morning. For guys like me, rating the presidents is such an interesting way to spend some time. Why are people so drawn to this thing?
I think they're drawn to it in the same way that they're drawn to questions about who's the greatest first baseman who ever lived,
yeah,
or who's the
no
greatest
kidding.
Singer. It's everything has its own rating game, doesn't it? Except that with regard to the presidency, it's really a question of these are guys who have the destiny of the country in their hands. So it has a lot more significance, and I believe that the game, the parlor game, as fun as it is, also lends some insights into how our system works and how our presidency works.
You know, historians, Bob, have been drawing up these lists for decades, but you're the first guy to consider the sentiments of voters at the time these different men were president. Why has that been overlooked for so long?
Well, I don't know. It's been something that's been on my mind for a long time.
Yeah.
I think maybe because, and we'll probably talk about Reagan, but because I had a sense that Reagan was a more successful president than a lot of intellectuals and historians thought he was. And so I came to the conclusion that you have to look at what the voters were thinking and were they, in fact, solid in their judgments. And I guess maybe it's a little bit like retailing. The customer is always right to a significant extent.
So they're the best judges in many cases.
In many cases. I mean, there are outlier situations here in which the voters and the historians are divergent. And I find that great fodder for discussion and analysis. Why was that the case? What kind of presidency emerged during those particular times? And so it was fun to look at those, and that forms a significant part of the book, really.
Hey, give us an example of a president who was viewed one way by the voters, a different way by the historians, Bob.
Well, my favorite example is Grover Cleveland, Stephen Grover Cleveland. we don't know much about Grover Cleveland as a country. He was a president in the 1880s and into the 1890s, and what we know about him is two things, really. He came from New York, Buffalo. And number two, he's the only president who served two non-consecutive terms.
That's right.
Now, what we don't really recognize is that after each of those terms, the voters promptly tossed out his party from the White House. The first time with him on the ballot, he actually won the popular vote, but he didn't win in the Electoral College. And the second time, the party basically said, you're not the guy we're going to put up here. And the voters turned to William McKinley. So Grover Cleveland is not only the only president who served two non-consecutive terms, he's the only president who is a two-time, one-term president.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, in the first poll that started all this, and you have to give him credit, Arthur Schlesinger Sr.
Back in the 40s, right?
In 1948, which was published in Life magazine, caused quite a stir, showed how much interest people have in their presidency. In that poll, he was ranked eighth. And I found myself scratching my head. Why would the historians say this guy was eighth when the voters basically couldn't wait to to show him the door on two separate occasions. So then you have to look at, well, what was happening during his presidency, and you can understand why the voters did that.
You know, I'm just wondering, you know, how do historians wind up rating these guys? How do they do it? Because, you know, the challenges facing any one president at one time are so different from the challenges that face a different president at a different time.
That's a flaw in the system, and that's a flaw in my book, frankly. I mean, I have to be sort of honest about that. There's no way of really making an allowance for that. You can't, you know, quantify what it was like to be president in the 1840s, for example, compared to what it's like to be president in the Cuban Missile Crisis. And so I basically don't get into that at all. I simply say, how good were they at maintaining what the voters wanted in the country? And what did the voters want? They want the same thing at all times. They want peace, or at least they don't want to go to a war that doesn't make sense or that we can't win.
Yeah.
They want prosperity. They want a good, solid economy that's growing. They want domestic tranquility. When you have civil unrest that leads to demonstrations and blood in the streets, that's a very serious negative. They don't want any scandals on the part of these guys or their administrations. So those are the kinds of things that ultimately determine whether a president's going to be considered successful by the voters.
How often have historians actually done these polls? How often does it happen?
I took seven. For this book, and I could have chosen more, but I picked what I thought were the most significant ones. But since 1948, you could probably go to his number, probably get to maybe 11 or 12.
Mm-hmm. And the first one being Arthur Schlesinger's that created – and why was that the first one? It seems like such an obvious thing to do.
It does, and I don't quite know the answer to that.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, no one had ever quite done anything like that before. And Arthur Schlesinger Sr. did an interesting thing. He said, I don't want you to be interested in anything that he did before or after his presidency. We're only talking about his presidential performance. And I want you to rank him as great, near great, average, below average, above average, below average, and failure.
Mm-hmm.
And then he codified all of those rankings or those categories to determine the actual rankings of the various presidents. And interesting, it's Lincoln, Washington, and Franklin Roosevelt.
Pretty much in that order.
In that order, almost always. There's one outlier in my polls.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, it's kind of a scramble. But there's a huge consensus that has emerged among the historians over time in terms of who are the presidents who deserve to be in that great or near great category. And I can sort of give you the ones they are. You probably would be, of course, Washington, then Jefferson, Jackson, Lincoln, Polk. James Polk is in there. Truman, Eisenhower, Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, who I disagree with that assessment for reasons that I explain in the book. And those are generally the presidents. I don't think I missed one, but I may have.
Now, there's one president you just mentioned who's very near and dear to your heart because you've written an acclaimed biography of him, and that was James Polk. And he's interesting because he was just a single-term president. So how could he possibly rank so high on so many historians' lists in terms of his performance in office?
Well, he was a one-term president for a reason that doesn't apply to any other president. He's the only president in our history who ran on a one-term promise. He got the nomination, and accepting the nomination, in those days you did it by letter, he said, if elected, I will not run again. And he abided by that commitment.
Yeah, why did he do that? Because, you know, at least in contemporary political thinking, that's such a damaging thing to say early on, that I'm only going to be here for one term, and people then can ignore you for those years and worry about who the next president is going to be.
Polk is an interesting case. He's a he's a fascinating man, not a particularly likable character in a lot of ways. I used to say in my speeches when I was traveling around hawking that book that if all of us, meaning me and whoever was in the audience, were at a bar someplace having a good time drinking and we happened to notice that Jimmy Polk was down at the other end of the bar drinking by himself, the question might come up, well, should we invite him over here to drink with us so he won't be by himself? Probably the answer would be no. He wasn't a particularly enjoyable character to be with. But he had some amazing traits, and one of them was that he was just relentless. He never gave up, and he was a man of vision. But the interesting thing about this promise, it had two rationales. One was public and idealistic, which wasn't really very sincere. He was a small government man. He was against entrenched power. So the shorter you were in power, then the more you were in keeping with his philosophy of being against entrenched power. But, of course, his great mentor, Andrew Jackson, had served two terms, and that didn't seem to bother him at all.
So, he sort of looked like Andrew Jackson, too.
In a way, he did. Yeah. Younger and smaller. But but the other was political and very significant. The party, the Democratic Party at that time, was populated by some big men and very ambitious men, Thomas Hart and Benton and John C. Calhoun and Van Buren, who had been president, wanted to get it back, and a couple of others, big guys. And he knew that those guys were not going to get behind him if they thought he was going to be tying up the presidency for 8 years. And the party needed to pull together in order to defeat Henry Clay, the great nemesis.
Mm-hmm.
So he made this promise so that he could get those guys behind him in the general election. And he won against Henry Clay by only about 38,000 votes.
I was going to say, you write in the book that if he hadn't made that deal, in a sense, that promise of a one term, he probably wouldn't have won the presidency.
I think he very likely would have lost.
Mm-hmm. So smart guy.
He was a very smart guy. He was a politically very adroit.
Yeah. If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date. We're visiting with author Robert Mary about his new book, Where They Stand, The Presidents in the Eyes of Voters and Historians. It's a very fun parlor game where he ranks the presidents and talks about different rankings that have occurred over our history. Where do you think Bill Clinton, Ronald Reagan, and George W. Bush should rank in history compared to the other presidents? And do you buy the idea that Lincoln, Washington, and FDR should rank 1, 2, and 3? Our phone number here, 816-235-2888, our email address, updatedate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Well, something else that's interesting to me about this book and our geography here in the middle of the country, we're in Eisenhower and Truman country here. And these are two presidents, Bob, who have seen their rankings move notably over the decades and move up in so many cases. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that. Where do Truman and Eisenhower rank these days, and why have they gone up the ladder over the years?
Well, the interesting thing about them is that they were close to each other in terms of geography. They were close to each other in terms of their service to the country in time, and they're close to each other in terms of their rankings.
Yeah,
they're generally – Eisenhower is a little bit below Truman, but he's generally ranked anywhere between, maybe 9th and 14th in the polls. Truman ranked anywhere between maybe 8th and 11th.
Hmm. Truman was such – when he left office, nobody liked him.
Well, let's talk about Truman because I love this guy. he's such a
we do too.
Natural, normal guy and very, very smart and extremely well-read about history and understood things and yet was a simple man in a lot of ways. Here's where you get to the big and significant distinction between how the voters view presidents and how historians view presidents.
Mm-hmm.
Historians view presidents in terms of their overall tenure and what they accomplished during that tenure, and that's the natural thing for them to do. The voters judge presidents based on how they were invited to do so by the Constitution and the Founding Fathers in 4-year increments. They have hiring and firing authority over these guys, and they take it very seriously. And so if you take that into account, it really explains Truman in terms of the voters and historians. So let me explain. Truman's first term, the inherited term from Franklin Roosevelt, was nothing less than heroic. I say that in the book. It was a heroic term. And if you just tick off what he accomplished, I mean, the agonizing decision to drop the bomb on Japan was a significant
two of them,
thing. He probably saved a million American lives in terms of having to invade those islands. The transition from wartime to a peacetime economy, which was done quite smoothly, amazing. Saving Western Europe through the Marshall Plan and the
airlift
and the support to Greece and Turkey and all the rest of it. Creating the Defense Department, the CIA. All these things were just tremendous, and they all occurred in just a very brief period of time. And the American people rewarded him with his own term, right? His second term was really kind of a disaster when you think about it. He got himself into a war that he couldn't control and couldn't get out of and couldn't win, which is poison for a sitting president.
Korea, right, yeah.
The economy was sputtering through a significant part of his second term. His administration was beset by some petty corruption on the part of some of his pals from around here, actually.
That's right. That's right.
Who were placed in positions that they probably shouldn't have been placed into. And so altogether, by the end of it, the Gallup poll ranking, which was new at that time, had him at a 22% approval rating. That is
horrible.
About as bad as it can get, yeah. Really, for a sitting president, if you can't get 22% approval. So what you see then is that he had his heroic first term, a mediocre, middling second term. The historians are looking at his overall performance and saying that it was great, which is true. The voters were looking at it in four-year increments and saying, this is great and worthy of being succeeded by himself. This not so much. And they turned to the Republican Party in 1952 in the form of Eisenhower.
And that's one of the big sort of pivot points that you examine and historians examine when it comes to ranking a president. If a president serves two terms, does his party maintain the presidency after he leaves office and the next president comes in? Is it a member of his party or not? That's one way to gauge how people really felt about this guy.
Well, probably the greatest accolade that the American people can bestow upon a president is to elect him. And then reelect him and then retain his party in power after his second
term. Like Ronald Reagan did with George H.W. Bush, yeah.
Yeah, it's rare. It doesn't happen very often. And it's one of the reasons is that 8 years is a long time to govern the country without being beset by some combination of economic dislocation, a war that goes awry, some kind of scandal, Iran-Contra in Reagan's case. Some kind of civic unrest that's problematical, those kinds of things.
Robert Mary's our guest. We're ranking the presidents from 1 to 45, right? We've had 45 of them now, and we want to know where you think Bill Clinton, Ronald Reagan, and George W. Bush should rank in history among those 45. And do you buy this idea that Lincoln, Washington, and FDR rank 1, 2, and 3? 816-235-2888 is our phone number, our email address, up to date at kcur.org. Let's go to Rick from Miriam. Rick, you're on Up to Date with Bob Mary. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Mr. Mary, I picked up your book yesterday, and I was delighted by one of the assessments you made, and it was of Woodrow Wilson. For years, I'd seen these rankings place Wilson as one of the better presidents of the United States, and I didn't understand that because although he's noted for his vision in terms of international relations, he didn't accomplish it at all. And domestically, students of certainly African-American history can say, gee, if not a flat-out racist, he was certainly a dedicated segregationist that probably set race relations back a little bit. And yet, continuously, I see these rankings rate him as very high, but you didn't. And I was just wondering if you could comment on that a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, I would love to comment on it. First thing I'll say is that this is a brilliant observation on your part, which I happen to agree with. I think that Woodrow Wilson is highly overrated by the historians. And if you go back to this four-year term assessment proposition that I was talking about earlier, you can see that his first term was not a disaster by any stretch. He kept us out of the war, which was his big slogan when he was running for re-election. He had some domestic policy successes, but you could see some traits. The man was incredibly sanctimonious and would never listen to anybody who disagreed with him at all. And you can see these traits were the kinds of traits that can catch up with the president turn him into an unsuccessful president. In his second term, not only did he get us into the First World War with a great sort of surge of idealism that didn't really come to pass in any significant way. But he screwed up things in Europe in a big way, in my view. And he destroyed the economy in doing so. So the American people just couldn't wait to get rid of that party when 1920 came along.
Rick?
Yes, I appreciate that. Also, like what you said about how difficult it is for someone to get elected for two terms and then pass on for their party to get elected again. People are talking about that now. You know, couldn't the Democrats win again? And I don't know. I mean, even no matter how great Obama turns out to be, it is difficult just because it's hard to maintain, 12 or 16 years in the White House.
Yeah, you bet. Rick, thanks for the good call. Appreciate it. You know, you wonder about a case like Bill Clinton, who serves two terms, then his vice president, Al Gore, obviously runs in 2000 and loses the presidency, although he won more popular votes. And a lot of folks would say Al Gore ran a lousy campaign. So why blame Clinton for that in the historical rankings if, you know, his vice president didn't run that great of a campaign?
I think that's one of the little elements of controversy that sort of pops out of my analytical framework here.
Yeah.
But I do believe that, and here's sort of a key to what I write and what I think, that presidential elections are largely referendums on the incumbent party or the incumbent president, and that the voters are looking, they're not really being swayed by the little stuff that political reporters, and I used to be one for many years.
we get hung up on.
You're so fixated on a gaffe in a debate, for example. They filter all that out. They're really looking at the performance of the incumbent and are they eligible for rehire?
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of Al Gore, I think that probably it was so close that his campaign performance contributed to his demise. And, of course, it was very, very close. And so it wasn't just a referendum, but I think they're largely referendums.
Yeah. Back to some phone calls at 816-235-2888. Dan from Kansas City, Kansas. Dan, you're on with Bob Mary. Good morning.
I'm glad to be with him, too. Great subject. You know, one guy that's always kind of mystified me is Zachary Taylor. When the author brought up Polk, this guy served, he was a one-termer in roughly the same era as Polk. And, you know, standing among those massive physically and reputationally large early Democrats, like Polk, he would not be the guy you'd want to have over for drinks. But he added more landmass to this country than anybody but Jefferson, and I've never heard him rank favorably at all. I know the Mexican War was not popular war, but it was also, he practically instigated it to fulfill his manifest destiny ambitions.
Let me ask Bob, Mary, why is Zachary, the old general, Zachary Taylor, getting a bum rap?
Well, I think that I would make a little bit of a correction here in that it was really Polk who added the landmass to our continental United States.
We're talking
States.
About Oregon. We're talking about California, right?
You know, and we're talking about the whole Southwest as mm-hmm. we know it now from Texas to the Pacific. Zachary Taylor succeeded Polk. He was a Whig. He was a general in the Mexican War and a very successful general. Here's what I'd say about Zach Taylor. He was a man of considerable lethargy. He was not intellectually curious about things, but he was interested in one thing, and that was military life. He could get very much involved in something that affected him immediately, especially if it had to do with battle. And he had a tendency as a military man to get himself into these sort of unfortunate and perhaps unnecessary scrapes, these situations, and then brilliantly get himself out of them. Polk, who was the president during this Mexican War when Zachary Taylor was out there, and the American people were not looking at it very carefully and sort of saying, wow, what a brilliant general he is. And Polk was sort of saying, I don't understand why he got himself into that situation in the first place. It wasn't really necessary. So they didn't get along at all.
Mm-hmm.
Polk didn't trust Whigs, and his generals were Whigs, which was a problem in terms of his relations with the military. Zachary Taylor became president after Polk. Polk was sort of somewhat shocked about it and upset about it. And then he died in office. So he wasn't in the presidency very long, and mm-hmm. I think that's one of the reasons why he doesn't get a lot of attention.
Yeah, I'm just amazed in one way, Bob, that an historian out there who has been asked over the decades to rank the presidents, again, from in these days, 1 to 45, how does any one person sort of have a feel for the history of all 45 of these men, because that's a pretty big bite of the apple. You're some of those pre-Civil War presidents. You're talking about Polk and Taylor. That's always been kind of a foggy area to me. I'm wondering, how does any one person know all this stuff to make a very comprehensive ranking of all these guys?
I think it's a very, very good question. And to be entirely honest, just between you and me and your audience here, I'm not sure they always do.
I was wondering.
My friend Steve Neal, the late Steve Neal.
Oh, like, sure. Chicago Tribune. Yeah.
Yes. He did one of these polls, which is included in my litany. He included me among the historians. And I have to say I've done a lot more research for this book on this, and I feel that I'm pretty well qualified now to discuss all of this. But at the time, I think that there were areas in which I was winging it a little bit, and I wasn't an academic, so perhaps I wasn't even qualified to be in the poll. But I have a feeling that some of these academics are specialists in their areas and may not be experts
Absolutely.
In other areas.
You know something about pre-Civil War, but you don't know anything about the 50s or something. Yeah, exactly. So.
But here's what I'd say about it. Given the fact that there have been numerous of these polls over time, and in the course of the ones that I talk about, there's probably almost 2,000 respondents who are giving a sort of collective judgment that, like all collective judgments, it tends to sort of siphon out the little elements of ignorance that might come along the way.
Sort of like Nate Silver in his 538 polls, where he compiles all the polls across the country and gives you an average, which hopefully knocks out all the outlier polls, I guess. Yeah,
that's the idea.
Okay. Yeah. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation here with Bob Mary. We'll get phone calls from Michael and Bill, so if you guys can hang on, please do. And if our listeners want to weigh in on how they rank the presidents, and particularly Bill Clinton, Ronald Reagan, and George W. Bush. Our lines are open 816-235-2888 and our email address uptodate@kcur.org. And I should point out that Bob Mary speaks tonight at 6:30 at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the Plaza Branch. To RSVP, go to kclibrary.org or call 816-701-3407. That's 6:30 tonight at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library on the Plaza. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's conversation with U.S. Congressman Emanuel Cleaver and Kevin Yoder, you can find it in all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. On tomorrow's program, we'll look at what goes on behind that employees-only door at hotels. Also, we'll talk with the new Speaker of the Missouri House, Tim Jones, about the upcoming session. This hour, we're visiting with Robert Mary. He's put together a new book, a very interesting book, Where They Stand, the American Presidents in the Eyes of Voters and Historians. Lots of talk in this book about the rankings of our presidents from 1 to 44 over the years and where the different presidents rank compared to the other. If you want to weigh in this morning on where you think Bill Clinton, Ronald Reagan, and George W. Bush rank, 816-235-2888 and our email address uptodate@kcur.org. Let's go to Michael from Lawrence. Michael, you're on the program. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks
Thank
for holding
you very
on.
Much
you
for
bet.
Having... Well, I would rank the presidents, those three presidents, exactly the way you listed them, with Bill Clinton way up there as number one. I mean, he was a very clever man, arguably the brightest man on the planet at that time, and oversaw a booming economy, left us with a surplus, and God knows how important. Now, NAFTA may have been a mistake. The only charge against him I could see, which is a silly one, and that's his sexual peccadilloes. But we have such a strong puritanistic streak in this country, and right-wing fundamentalists, that they want to condemn everybody to hell and doesn't think the way they do. Obviously, Ronald Reagan is an icon in the Republican Party, and they treat him like a saint. But if he were around today, he never would have gotten a nomination against Obama. That's very clear. The first month of his term in office, he had 10% unemployment, and nobody screamed that it was all his fault. He had interest rates went up to an ungodly amount. Mm-hmm. I remember some people paying 16% mortgage on their home.
Well, Michael, here's the tougher question. Where do you think Clinton and Reagan and George W. Bush would rank among all 44 presidents?
Well, I think Clinton would rank very highly. I really do. And
top 10?
Pardon?
Top 10?
Yes, I do. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think he would be in the top 10.
How about Ronald Reagan?
No way.
Hmm.
No way in the top 10. I think that Obama will qualify for the top 10 in a few years.
All right.
But right now, the racism in this country is just staggering. I lived the last 30 years overseas in Europe, and I'm shocked out of my socks
right.
over the racism and and it pervades our system with 3/4 of everybody in prison, which is the highest prison population in the world, being minority, black
okay.
or brown.
Michael, thank you for the phone call. I appreciate it. Let's go to Bill from Overland Park. Bill, you're on the program.
Well, Mike kind of took some of my thunder, but I want to start out by saying that it seems like Ronald Reagan and JFK have to be the two most overrated presidents we've ever had.
Hmm.
And I picked both because I'm an independent voter. I voted for Ross Perot. I was reluctantly voted for Obama, but because I liked Hillary Clinton. I voted Ronald Reagan both times, but I felt this is the reason why. You know, it's like saying, well, okay, if Ronald Reagan, or let's say, why didn't Kennedy or why didn't Eisenhower stand in front of the Berlin Wall and just simply ask the Soviets to tear down this wall? And then this just... God, they just tore down the wall, you know, and it's like he gets by the conservatives get apoplectic if you say one bad thing about Reagan. I mean, Sam Donaldson was shown the door when he was in the Rose Garden trying to ask Reagan a simple question.
Mm-hmm.
Same way with Kennedy. And it seemed like Kennedy's pictures and Jacqueline Kennedy's pictures are all over this, like Camelot. And what did he do? We had the pig invasion that went very bad.
Right.
The nuclear attack almost happened on the United States. I mean, the only time we came to the brink of a nuclear war was under Kennedy. And, it's almost like the only analogy I can give in the music world is that you've got Jimi Hendrix, who was only alive for a short period of time, wrote a lot of good music. But JFK didn't write a lot of good music, didn't
yeah.
write a lot of legislation. What he wanted to do with civil war, with the civil rights movement, had to be done by Johnson. That's my one comment. Then let's look at Obama.
Go quickly, Bill.
Obama he's in his second term, and second terms usually go bad, as you know. And he's on a different timeline and a historic. His wife is sitting there going, how do I write history now? Help my husband write history. He's trying to get the Congress to do the day-to-day nuts and bolts thing, and they are on a different timeline, you know,
right.
than he is. And he's going to do you know, if he gets this so-called fiscal cliff thing done, it's probably going to be a huge thing because most of my conservative friends, who are 90% of them right here in Kansas City, absolutely hate Obama.
Okay, Bill, I'm going to scoot down. I got other folks I got to get to. But Bill raises an interesting point, Bob, which is why does JFK rank as high as he does in so many polls? Where is he, at least in a consensus idea, where does he rank these days?
Probably ranks generally in the above average category, which is probably higher than – it's hard to know where to place him because he didn't really have an opportunity to do all that he wanted to do. And
of the 44 presidents, you're saying what, 12, 13, somewhere in there?
Yeah. 15, 16, generally,
mm-hmm.
somewhere around there.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of say in my book that it's really impossible to place the man for the simple reason that he didn't have an opportunity to do all that he wanted to do. Now, you could say, well, he had 3 years. Well, sure, but he had 4 years in which to get it done, and the American people weren't going to assess him negatively if he got most of it done in the final year. So we just really can't assess the man. We do know that he was a man of great style and grace, and he was somebody to really look up to. But the caller is correct in saying that he didn't really accomplish very much.
Well, where does Bill Clinton rank? And I'm wondering, is it too early to really assess where he should stand?
It is too early. I believe that it really takes about a
generation
before
20 years or so,
you can
yeah.
sort of wash out the passions of the moment. And we see that even here in our conversations with some of the callers regarding Reagan, although he's had close to a generation. Let me talk about Bill Clinton a little bit, because I think he's a very, very interesting president. He came in as a minority president with a 44% vote total, and attempted to govern like he had a 55% mandate. The voters handed his head to him in the next midterm elections by giving the Congress over to the Republicans, both House and Senate.
This is after he tried health care reform and it didn't work,
obviously. In 1994.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what Clinton did after that was very brilliantly calibrate a really careful center-left means of governing, which was very much in keeping with the American people. You may remember we came in and he made a comment that his aim was to repeal Reaganism. Bad mistake for a president to basically say, you know, the American people were really rather stupid when they elected Reagan, and I'm going to repeal Reaganism. Mm-hmm. The American people don't want to repeal the presidents that they've had in the past, especially presidents have done a lot, as Reagan had done. And so he stopped trying to repeal Reaganism, and he said instead the era of big government is over. Mm-hmm. And he governed that way. And he governed very, very effectively, as the earlier caller noted, with a very strong economy, with a very good productivity growth. Took care of the deficit, which very few presidents have managed to do that. So he gets high marks. Here's where he gets low marks. Once he did that, he was building up a significant amount of political capital. He didn't have any crisis. Mm-hmm. So what was he going to do with that political capital? He didn't do very much of it with it at all. And I think that in order for him to really be considered a significant president or even a great president, he was going to have to do something to really change the direction of the country in a favorable way. Well, and he didn't do that.
Well, that's why, you know, I sort of wonder about relying on the sentiments of voters in many cases, because, you know, oftentimes with a president, and you sort of refer to this with Bill Clinton, you know, just being popular with voters is one thing, but occasionally you have to do something in the best interest of the country, whether or not that's popular with the voters. And I'm wondering how you sort of gauge that when it comes to relying too heavily on how the voters themselves feel about any one president.
I tend to think that the voters generally sort it out and end up appreciating those tough decisions that presidents make. So ultimately, it sort of comes out in the wash.
Mm-hmm.
But there's always a possibility that the voters are going to get it wrong. Our system is predicated on the idea that if they do, they'll have an opportunity to redirect things at the next election.
You sort of wonder, you know, about Barack Obama with his health care reform plan, which has proven so unpopular, at least in some quarters of the country, and different questions now about how effectively he can implement his plan even in a second term, even after having won re-election. You wonder how that's going to sort out in the long run, too.
I think it's going to be tough for him. I think he's going to have a hard time having a successful second term just because of the forces and pressures that are bearing down on him, but he's proved himself to be a very resourceful politician, and there's a strong chance that he'll figure out how to do it.
How about George W. Bush, the more recent of the two Bush presidents? A lot of Democrats consider him to be a failed president. How do you think he's going to shake out?
I don't think history is going to look at him very favorably. It's hard for me to see that. I know a lot of people think he's going to be like Truman and that they're going to look back and say, well, the voters were wrong and his second term. George W. Bush's first term was a middling success, and he had a middling electoral outcome when he ran for re-election. And I think that's what you would expect. But he got us into a war that he really couldn't control and couldn't figure out what to do, and it didn't really have the outcomes and the favorability that he promised when he took us to war. He presided over a meltdown of the economy. That's poison for a sitting president. So I think that he's going to be down there in the lower reaches ultimately.
Do you agree or not with what Bob Murray just said? 816-235-2888 and our email address update@kcur.org. Let's go to Meredith from Kansas City, Missouri. Meredith, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
You know, I have a second major in American history just because it interested me, not because I ever intended to do anything with it. So this kind of conversation really interests me as far as the more recent presidents. You know, I remember I was in high school when Reagan ran for re-election, and I remember looking at stuff saying, you know, how the rich got richer and the poor got poorer. And I don't think that that's going to, you know, in the end, I don't think that's going to hold up, you know, very positively for him. W, I think, belongs down at the bottom with Hoover. I think that, you know, he's just a disaster. And frankly, I feel like he stole the election twice. He just got better at it the second time. Hmm. Clinton had positives, but he also had negatives in that, you know, he went ahead and continued with, you know, the deregulation of you know, the financial systems, which I think, you know, ultimately led us to, you know, what, you know, the meltdown. And, you know, and so I don't think that that will, you know, I don't think that that, you know, I don't think that will probably be in his plus column, right, as history has it. I also am not, I don't think that Lincoln deserves, like, you know, number one. I mean, he kept the, you know, he kept the country together, but in some ways, I don't know that that was totally a positive, simply because, you know, that just the federal powers just expanded beyond, right, belief. And it wasn't like he did it, you know, believing in the, you know, in, like, you know, we're going to free the slaves, because he started out saying, if I can, you know, if I can keep the country together without freeing a single slave, I'll do it.
Right. Murda, thanks for the call. I'm going to need to move on here. We have an email here from Jeff who writes, which president would you say was the most concerned with his own legacy while in office?
Well, they all really care about their legacy. It's especially
They're very aware of it, aren't they?
Very much aware of it, and especially in the second term, if they get a second term. One person who was obsessed with his legacy in a tragic way, really, was Lyndon Johnson. Hmm. Almost everything he did was intended to bring glory and attention to himself. He was a man of immense ego, and yet he got us into that Vietnam War, and it destroyed him.
Where does he rank today in most polls?
Probably lower than he deserves to be ranked because of the Vietnam War and the disaster that imposed, and the fact that he was essentially tossed out of, you know, forced out of office, pushed sort of chased out of office, if you will.
Top 20,
and
or?
Yet, I'd say probably right around there. And yet, the domestic policies in that first term, and even in 1965. Voting Rights Act, et cetera, deserve a great deal of attention.
Who are the presidents, Bob, who are regarded as failures almost universally? Who's in the bottom category here?
Well, my bottom person is James Buchanan, who not only, I believe, was our worst president. He presided before Lincoln. He basically refused to do anything about this looming crisis that was enveloping the country, simply because he didn't have the guts to even try to deal with it.
Those presidents before Lincoln, any number of them suffered because the times were so tough, the slavery issue so contentious, and they struggled to get their arms around it, clearly.
Franklin Pierce was Buchanan's predecessor. He's also in that category. Mm-hmm. Often Warren G. Harding is down there in that. In fact, he's often listed as the worst.
Even though the economy was booming during his time,
I take exception to that, Randy. Mm-hmm. I think he deserves to be up there higher. He did preside over a booming economy, and he not only presided over a booming economy, but he turned it around because he inherited Woodrow Wilson's economic morass. So I think he deserves better than he gets.
It's a teapot dome scandal that oftentimes nips Warren Harding in the backside.
Scandals,
right,
will do that. Ulysses Grant was down there in the failure category in the early polls.
But not so much anymore, though.
No, he's moving up, mm-hmm, largely because in the academic circles there's a sort of changed viewpoint regarding Reconstruction and the real hard-nosed, hard-line radical Republicans of the Congress are not looked upon with so much askance as they were in previous decades.
How about Richard Nixon?
Well, that's a tough one, because a man who abused the office and was the only president to resign in disgrace, it's hard for you to say that he was anything but a failure. At the same time, he did some amazing things on foreign policy and also domestic policy, and yet he doesn't kind of get credit for that. I think what happens is that it's hard to sort of figure out how you how you sort of find an average from a man who has this abject failure and yet accomplished a lot. And so and he ends up being down there in the failure category by most polls.
Just because of Watergate and most everything else. And, you know, when you were talking about Clinton, you didn't mention his impeachment. And yet he's the second president in our history to ever suffer that terrible fate there.
I don't, largely because I think that it was I mean, whatever you think of what the Republicans did in terms of pushing that impeachment and the trial in the Senate, I think it was monumentally stupid from a political standpoint. Nevertheless, it does reflect, I think, that Clinton conducted himself in a manner that most people were highly uncomfortable with. Mm-hmm. And they were a little sickened to see their president behave in the manner that he did in the office that he held. And yet it didn't really seem to have a huge impact on his ability to govern or certainly in his standing with the American people today.
Bob Merry's our guest. He's a longtime Washington correspondent. He's the author of a new book, Where They Stand, The American Presidents in the Eyes of Voters and Historians. Again, you can see and hear Bob tonight at 6:30 at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library on the plaza. To RSVP, go to kclibrary.org. You can give us a call right now, too, to join our conversation, 816-235-2888. Let's go to Jim from Kansas City, Missouri.
Hi, I'm sorry, I missed the first part of the show, so this may have already been talked about. But
shame on you, Jim.
That's the way it goes. sorry. Anyhow, I heard it mentioned once, and admittedly it's probably a bias, but how does Harry Truman rank in there?
You missed a little bit of our previous conversation.
Yeah, we did
about
say
it,
Harry Truman is he's consistently in the near great category and deserves to be there, in my view. Because the American people didn't really appreciate him towards the end of his tenure, doesn't mean that he didn't accomplish some really amazing things.
All right. Jim, thank you for the phone call. Lots of email here. Roger writes us this, Bob. I think it matters how the question is asked. If it's asked who was influential, then Reagan would be high. But if it was asked long-term good, then Reagan would be at the bottom. His movement of the economy to trickle-down economics has put the nation in chronic recession that gets better and worse, but never good.
Well, I'm glad. Let's talk about Reagan a little bit. I'm going to take this opportunity to talk about Reagan. I talk about the presidents that I call men of destiny, and these are the presidents who really changed the political landscape and set America on a new course. And I have certain criteria for how they get defined as men of destiny, but they are Washington, Jefferson, Jackson, Lincoln, T.R., F.D.R. I think Reagan ultimately is going to be listed by historians as one of these men of destiny. And here's what he did. He inherited an economy. People forget just how bad it was. This inflation was destroying the fabric of America, and it was accompanied by tremendous dislocations and recession. So it was stagflation, as they called it at the time. He turned that around, and he took a major recession in order to do it and could have destroyed himself politically. And he never wavered in supporting the Fed chairman, Paul Volcker, when he was wringing inflation out of the economy. And he transformed the debate in America and moved economic growth back to the forefront, which the Democrats, which had pretty much governed for a long time, had lost sight of. So he set America on a new course in doing that. I think he set in motion the productivity growth that came from the surge in technological development that was thwarted because of tax policy. And that has been basically running the economy ever since and contributed tremendously to Bill Clinton's successes as well. Then he turned his attention to foreign policy at a time when people thought that he was a nutcase kind of a guy who all he wanted to do was go to war with the Soviets.
Yeah.
And he turned out to be a very deft negotiator with Mikhail Gorbachev, the Soviet leader, to such an extent that ultimately, and he'd already essentially bankrupted him with his military policies. Going toe-to-toe with them, he essentially made it impossible for the Soviet Union to carry on its former policies. So he's a man of tremendous significance in our political landscape.
And so much of our economic policy since has been to stave off inflation. That's been a core bedrock principle of American economic policy ever since.
And should be, because that inflation was very debilitating.
Ron from Leawood writes us this, Bob. Clinton is in the top 10, Reagan middle of the pack, George W. Bush bottom 10 or bottom 5 for the premeditated attack on Iraq, planned before he was inaugurated, he says, and his lies. What about Hoover? Ron asks. He was a tremendous force in the rebuilding of Europe, he writes, after World War I and the management of the aftermath of the 1928 Mississippi flood. What happened after he was elected?
He was a failure, and he deserves to be down there in the failure category, where he has not been much of the time in these polls of historians. I think he deserves to be down there because, true enough, he might have inherited some of the factors that led to the Great Depression, but his job was to try to get us out of it or to ameliorate the problems. He made it worse with by signing the Taft-Hartley Act, raising tariffs, and then raising taxes in a way that just was devastating to the economy. So I think that Hoover was a fine man and a very smart man and had a lot of accomplishments before his presidency, but his presidency was a failure.
Jeff from Richmond, Missouri writes this, although I'm a giant Lincoln fan, I would rate Washington before him. He ranks it as Washington, Lincoln, then FDR. This for one reason. He stepped down after two terms. This one act did more to prevent president-for-life presidents than anyone else.
Probably there's no president who was elected at a time when it was more important to have a man who knew how to set the nation on its course than was the case with Washington. And he never made a misstep in any of that in those 8 years.
Is there much of a debate these days, Washington versus Lincoln, 1-2 in all these polls? I mean, Lincoln seems to be coming out on top in most.
Lincoln is on top, but I don't think there's much of a debate because not very many people are very emotional about it. You can go either way.
Yeah, okay. Bob, it's been a pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
Really enjoyed having you. Interesting book. Yeah, just a great conversation. That's Robert Mary. His book, again, is titled Where They Stand, The American Presidents in the Eyes of Voters and Historians. Again, he speaks this evening at 6:30 at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. That's at 4801 Main Street. You can just show up and hear Bob speak. You can find those details, more information about our program, and archive broadcasts of our show at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date. Tomorrow on the show, we'll look behind the front desk of the hotel industry. Also, we'll check in with the new Speaker of the Missouri House. His name is Tim Jones. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, and Beth Lipoff. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.